Now I am.
Okay. I'm going to call this meeting to order. Today is Monday, September 27th, 2021, and this is the working session of the Elizabeth School District Board of Directors. And it is 6 o'clock p.m. Can we get roll call, please?
Director Bender?
Here.
Director Funkfeller?
Here.
Director Haynes?
Here.
Director Carter?
Here.
Please stand and join me in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay. I got to turn this stuff off. Can I get a motion to approve the agenda?
So moved.
Second. Second.
Is there any discussion? Roll call, please.
Director Bender?
Yes.
Director Funkfeller?
Yes.
Director Haynes?
Aye.
Director Carter?
Aye.
Can I get a motion to approve the minutes from the board meeting of September 13th, 2021?
So moved.
Second.
Any discussion? Roll call, please.
Director Bender?
Yes.
Director Funkfeller?
Yes.
Director Haynes?
Aye.
Director Carter?
Aye.
Can I get a motion to approve the minutes from the board meeting, the special board meeting of September 22nd, 2021?
So moved.
Second.
Any discussion? Roll call, please.
Director Bender?
Yes.
Director Funkfeller?
Yes.
Director Haynes?
Aye.
Director Carter?
Aye.
You have no education showcase? We would have waited for you. So next up, we have communications with the superintendent.
This is the fastest we've gotten to you. Didn't give you much prep time,
really
sorry.
Sad. Sorry about that.
But it doesn't mean you should take till 6:45. I'm just kidding.
That's right. He's looking at the clock going, I got 30 minutes.
Yes, yeah. Yeah.
30,
wait a minute.
Two to go.
I thought he was looking at something to throw at you.
That too. No.
That was good.
I just need to get the projector going. That I provided the board at the last board meeting regarding the growth of our students as measured by CMAS last spring. And I didn't have anything in writing for you because it had just been released that day. And so I wanted to go over that, show you the numbers. This is just straight from the Department of Education. It's a file that can be found on their website. Can you read those numbers or should I make it a little bigger?
I'm good. Are you okay, Carol?
I can see distance.
No,
it's just
so
up close that I can't see.
Okay. So the state did a number of things differently this last spring, but one of them was they only required tests, one test per grade level. So for example, English language arts, for fifth grade, you see the grade level there. There. So the fifth graders weren't tested in math. They had the opportunity to take the test, but they weren't required to take it. We offered the fifth graders the math test. And so the sixth graders took math, the seventh graders took English language arts, the eighth graders took math. So they only were required to take one, but we offered both of them to every grade level. So their reporting is half as much as we normally see, because usually you see a math and a language arts for every grade level. So Because they only required half, then they only reported growth for the required tests. And so what I've done is I've just gone into the file and I've sorted it by grade level, and then I sorted it by the median growth percentile. The cohort reference median growth percentile means that the state median growth percentile is 50th percentile. That's right in the middle. So if you're above 50, it means your students had more growth relative to other districts or other students that had similar stuff. So this is just sorted by their cohort reference mean growth percentile. So why? Oh, there. So you can see this is the lowest. It's 14. You'll have median growth percentiles very close to zero and close to 99.
Okay.
But there are 107 districts that are reported. There's 170 or so that exist, but the small districts, because of the small number of students, they don't report them. So there were only 107 that in fifth grade for English Language Arts that had enough to report.
Okay.
So, you know, you can see Big Sandy here is in Elbert County there. And I just highlighted Elizabeth. So Elizabeth is there at 55th percentile, 29th highest growth percentile of all the districts that were measured.
Out of 107.
Out of 107.
Right.
And then what I did was I just highlighted some of the districts around that we like to compare ourselves to and that have strong academic performance. So you can see it's really the same as Douglas County. If we look down here, Academy 20 was at 60th. But I think Boulder typically has strong growth. If we look down lower growth percentiles, Littleton, 52. Another one that we compare to is Cherry Creek, 49. Now, we could pick any districts here that we found useful to compare to. So that's fifth grade language arts. Then I'm going to just go down in this file here. And now, this is the seventh grade. So if you see here, the seventh grade. Again, the way that I just have it sorted was the lowest growth percentile to the higher ones. So as I scroll down, I'll just stop and point out the districts around us that I've highlighted. I didn't highlight Boulder, so they're there. Cheyenne Mountain typically has very strong performance. You can see where they are. One down here. Lewis Palmer typically has strong performance. You can see there where they are at 52. Cherry Creek, they're also at 52. We'll keep going down. Littleton, they're at 57. Douglas County at 65. And Elizabeth,
wow,
sixth highest in the school.
Oh, that's awesome.
Fantastic.
Wow. So that was seventh grade English language arts.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah. And then let me make this a little bit bigger. So again, it's the same order, but now we're with math, and this is sixth grade math, and then second we'll see eighth grade math.
Okay.
There's 110 here.
And there's 110 here. Okay, so I'm going to just scroll through this a little bit. slowly. So if you see districts there that you, you know, want to use as your own reference point, you see Cherry Creek there, 46th percentile, 76th in the state.
St. Vrain's kind of interesting too. They're right at 46.
Right. Also, yep. Boulder, they're at 49. Academy 20 at 53. Elizabeth at 54. And Littleton was at 57. Most of these others were relatively small. Douglas County at 67, so they did well on sixth grade math. It was Palmer, you see there, 79, they did well on math. And then we scroll down now. See, these are all the ones that were so small they didn't have enough to do well. At the eighth grade, scroll through it here slowly, so if there's districts that you're interested in seeing, again, Cheyenne Mountain, 47. Mm-hmm. You see the St. Vrain there, Lewis Palmer at 51 and a half, Cherry Creek at 53 there, at the bottom, see there. Douglas County, they're at 55. Telluride typically scores pretty high on all of these. They're smaller, they're a little bit smaller than us. You see Elizabeth there, 58, 31st in the state. Boulder is 1 point higher. Littleton is 61 there. And I think that's the end of the ones that we were highlighting against. So I think that there was an impression that our teachers had last year as they were teaching, that they knew how their students are doing, and that they were doing well, that they were engaged, and they were making good progress, that the teachers felt satisfied with the amount of progress that our students were making. And I think this is evidence of that.
Yeah.
You know, across the board, above state average or median growth percentile, and relative to our neighboring larger districts that typically have more resources, and that when we look at state rankings and so forth, we compare ourselves to it. So, I don't know if you have any questions. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. The test participation rate, so on all the other grade levels, they were about in the 90%, give or take, and then the eighth grade here is at 65%. So if I'm gonna assume that if it was like in the 90 percentile, then we, for the participation rate, that our numbers would have been a little bit higher. Or how do they analyze that percentage?
It's the percent of eighth grade students that take the test, correct?
That math test, correct.
The math test.
So
if we had 90% participate, it may or may not change the MGP.
I think that it's a reach to assume what it would be if you had a higher participation rate without really looking specifically at who did and who didn't participate. For example, did the 100% online students participate or not? If you know, maybe a higher percentage did or did participate, or a higher percentage didn't participate. And to look at what scores maybe those students had in the past, to come to some conclusion about whether the high-performance students opted out or not. But if you look at the participation rates of some of the other districts, for example, Boulder had lower than us. You go down here, Littleton only had 28%. So the variability. Douglas County had lower
buyers.
10%. Buyers, yeah.
Buyers.
Cherry Creek had 31. Four kids taking.
Yeah.
So it's really, I mean, what the participation rate, you can see D49 there, 27 or 28%. What it begins to tell you is how much confidence you can have in the numbers just as a single number. And so I think we saw in the English language arts, you know, a higher percentage there. Typically, the smaller districts are getting higher percentages. They're just dealing with 20 or 30 kids taking the test. And we tend to see, over time, lower participation as kids get older. So you can see here the fifth grade, which is the youngest that showed up with growth, was 90%. Both students and parents seem to value the tests less over time. So if they've been taking them in third grade, fourth grade, fifth grade, sixth grade, seventh grade, eighth grade, you have, and then you get into high school, the challenges of, are the parents opting their kids out because they don't want them to be taking tests, they don't care, they don't need the information? Are the kids continuing to take the test seriously? I know at the middle school they've worked very hard to have the students take the test seriously because they use the data. And the students know that, and they celebrate all students, whether or not they took the test or not. The official participation rate is, there's two of them. So the actual number of percentage of kids that took the test, and then if you combine that with the parents that gave an opt-out, you need to be above 95% to meet accreditation thresholds. And we did in every case. So even though the participation rate might have been 65%, there were another 30, close to, you know, somewhere between 30 and 35% that opted out and officially said, we don't want our kids to take the test. Mm-hmm. If you don't have enough parents saying that, then the state looks more negatively on your scores because you don't have an adequate number of kids participating. I don't know if you remember when the state accepted opt-outs. Mm-hmm. And so the ones that we're seeing here are the actual ones versus the kind of accountability participation rate, which includes the opt-outs. So I think as a school, they can look at that and as a grade level and say, okay, 65% of 8th graders took this test, and this is what the score was. That's a starting point that they will look into their individual students' growth scores to really say, and individual items, because they'll be able to look at how they did on individual items. I don't know if they can do it by student, when they change the test, the tools that they give us and the information they give us changes over time. But they can certainly look across like a grade level and see they didn't score as well on these types of questions. And then it's feedback for their curriculum the next year. Even though typically what it'll be is that grade level will look at their curriculum for the next year, even though it's a different group of students. So they'll want to do better with their 8th graders in their content area. We try to pass it along then to the next grade so that they can look at it, but it really depends on the staff and how systematic it is. Especially if you're at the high school, they're using PSAT as their measure. Are the math or the English teachers really looking at a whole class and changing based on the group's test scores? Sometimes they're able to do that, but it's really a lot of work for the teachers, and sometimes it's not really possible. It's not an effective strategy. So it's so how much they use it for the next grade will depend on the particular department or the particular group of teachers and how they're working that year with the data. I don't know if that makes it more confusing or whether that's helpful.
You had me at hello. I got it.
So the detail, you know, too. So, you know, this is how you scored in language arts, and then it's broken down by category within language arts, right? So they at least know where they have challenges that they need to work on, so they can go back and use that
according to the different standards.
Yeah,
and so it'll show them what they did better in one standard versus right. the other, and that's available to the teachers as well. But it's very difficult, especially both middle school and high school. When you might have 120, 130 students to remember all of them, and at the high school you're going to be teaching different levels, and they do their best to try to adapt to this data, especially over time, to look at if there's something that their students tend to be weak in over time. But it determines, sometimes the school will set a goal, sometimes the department will set a goal to try to improve performance in an area. And they measure it over time.
I think Pam had a great example 3 years ago, my first year on the board, where she was talking about improvement on language arts and a focus on language arts because of the results of the scoring that came out here. And you saw a continual uptick in those scores over time.
Right.
And it's still being reflected here.
That's awesome.
The state, in their accreditation and rating system, values growth a lot. It gets double and sometimes triple counted because of how they're looking at it. Because they look at growth gaps, they look at growth. And that the important thing is how much students are learning in a year. It's important how much they know, and so looking at achievement levels is a whole different kind of set of numbers.
So to clarify, because I don't know if Kim knows, Johnson here anymore, the growth, when they're talking about growth in fifth grade, and they test every fifth grade, they're not talking following those kids to the next year, their growth. They're talking about from one fifth grade to the next fifth grade. Correct.
Or they do that with achievement. So when they talk about fifth grade test scores went down, they're talking about a different group of fifth graders.
Okay.
So, you know,
yeah, it's not following the same kids.
This though does follow the kids. So
okay.
what this does is it compares their scores. And I don't know how they do this because I don't believe they took the test the year before.
Yes. Yeah.
So I think it goes back to what they did as third grade.
Okay, so they're comparing maybe every
growth
other year.
From third grade. Growth.
In this case, because of the pandemic, they didn't have testing
right.
in the spring.
Right.
So I think that's why this is the first score, is fifth grade test scores, is they had to go back to third grade. Normally the first would be fourth grade, but this year's fourth grader, or last year's fourth graders, didn't have a third grade test to compare.
So how will they do these fifth graders next year in sixth grade?
Yeah, they'll keep comparing. So
just
let's
whatever their previous year is.
Yes, and they'll look at what their achievement score is, and they'll. This is a little bit of an oversimplification, but the problem is if you really try to get into it, you need like a PhD because it's all about statistics and so forth. But anyway, they'll take all the kids with similar scores from the whatever the base. So in this case, it would be third grade. And then they see what all their scores were in as fifth graders. And they say that the median is 50. And so if they grew more than their peers, because they all have this same starting point, they have a higher growth percentile. If they grew less than their peers, then they have a lower than 50. And so it does track. It's the same student. So this student in third grade, this student in fifth grade, and the starting point is all the students with similar test scores in third grade. How much did they grow?
So I got them flipped. So achievement is the one that they follow each third grade.
Yeah, and it's sometimes, I mean, you'll see educators, I think rightly, really challenge this idea of, you know, this fifth grade class did worse than last year's fifth grade class because it's a different set of students.
Right.
And those numbers typically don't change a lot, but they'll maybe change by a percentage or two in terms of the percentage of fifth graders that are proficient or exceed the standards. Does that make, and that's their categories, how many are meeting and how many are exceeding.
Got it.
Okay. So that was part one.
You got 10 minutes, of time.
Right? Oh, he does? I was just going to say you're 5 minutes overdue.
We'll take question time off.
Though. Yeah, yeah, that's true.
It's okay.
Okay. So it does have more time left.
No.
Okay, I need to do. See if this works. Okay. So switching gears to COVID and where both the state and the county stand as of today. There's so much information in the media now about COVID.
Go ahead. I'm trying to eat. It's good.
And a lot of what we read in the media is national. And we do, depending on what you're paying attention to, whether you're, you know, looking at a state or regional publication, whether you're getting it on the TV or talk radio, you know, what I've realized is that people are getting their information from all kinds of different sources, sources that they like, that they trust, and our messages aren't that frequent. And unless you're going to the sources, you may not know what the State Department of Public Health is putting out. So I just wanted, this is from today, this is from their website, and they look at three things. I looked at three things that are categorized. One is the number of cases, the other is hospitalization, and the other is deaths. And those are the three things that they're tracking. They're tracking a few other things, but so this is just showing that it's as of today, and the source, and it's updated, I believe, daily.
At four.
Pardon me?
Four. At four.
And this is static here. This is kind of the, I think, the total numbers. But here, these, all of these are clickable. And so I went into case summary. I also went into demographics. I went into hospitalization.
Incidence. And
hospital data.
Epidemics curve.
Yes. And I went in there. And I just pulled out trends that I thought might be interesting and useful for you. So, so there's so many slides and so much information. I tried to get a kind of comprehensive when I could. The state.
I'm so sorry. I hit the wrong button on my watch.
There's worse things.
That's just finding your phone.
I know where your phone. I know where your phone is, though.
Found it.
Yeah.
God, I'm so sorry.
So just as I go through this, even though this is on a PowerPoint with Elizabeth School District letterhead, this is all CDPHE. It's screenshots taken today. And what I'm going to do is just try to highlight what it is, because there's like all these rectangles up here, and maybe you can see, you know, this is reported
week.
Yep. You can do by day. And then on the bottom there, you have the dates from the beginning of the pandemic. The red bars are increases, and the blue bars are decreases. So you see from the summer here, kind of in July, the increasing number of cases reported by week. And then in the last 4 weeks, three of them have been decreases. So I think this bar will end up being bigger, because I think that's from today. It says October 1st, but it's just the date on the axis.
Yeah. Right.
This is reported by day, so that one's by week, this is by day. And you can see that the numbers have been dropping off. This is the 7-day average of COVID cases in Colorado by date reported to the state.
And that's through September, or through September 1st?
No, it's actually further, because this date here
is right there.
Okay. This is as of the 23rd, 24th. They have a couple of things by map that are displayed by map, so you can see the whole state. So this is the case rate per 100,000. I think that's really important for counties like Elbert that's sparsely populated. And the lighter the shade, the fewer cases. And so Elbert here is a lighter shade, and it's 8,900 cases per 100,000. And you can see, these are the darker ones, and you can see their numbers here, you know, a lot in the 12 and 13,000 per 100,000.
Douglas, that's since the start of the pandemic, though, correct? That's not since the start of the year, or...
Right.
Because that seems...
I'm making the same assumption that you are.
That seems awfully high.
Right. Because it doesn't... It doesn't give us more information.
Yeah, right, right. Okay.
There. But okay. That's my assumption based on the size of the
number. Yeah, that would be my interpretation as well. Okay.
But it would be the cases per 100,000 over the course of the pandemic. This one is the same thing, but I just did two things. One, I highlighted El Paso County, and so it's 12,500 per 100,000. But I also shifted... this list, this yellow line is the state average, and you can see Elbert County. This is the lowest number of cases, Custer County, over the course of the pandemic per 100,000, and that Elbert County is on the much lower end of counties in the state. I haven't counted.
Bottom 20.
So you can, these were the top ones. There's a whole bunch more in the middle. And you can see this line here running down. Did you have a question?
She was wondering why Kiowa was on there.
Kiowa County.
County, yeah.
Kiowa County is...
Okay.
East, it's kind of just under Cheyenne, I think.
Maybe it's under the...
Yeah.
The tab, okay.
Down there.
Sorry.
Yeah, it does get confusing.
Yeah, because I was like, why is that...
Yeah, I covered it
both times.
I think it's down here.
It is.
Cases at 8.9% for the entire pandemic, you know, the period of the pandemic. So I wonder what that number would look like this month. Did it go up? Did it?
Yeah, there are ones that are more recent. So
I can really look. I'm just kind of curious, because it seems like a high number since the start of the pandemic. 8.9%.
But remember, it's per 100,000.
Right.
So the total number in the county is much, much lower.
Right.
It's not 8,900.
It would be 8.9% of our population in the county.
Right? Yeah. Yeah, I agree. So this is looking at hospital data based on vaccination status. And what it says is that 81% of those currently hospitalized, so that's currently, are unvaccinated. And we hear this number, I think, in the media a lot, that the majority of hospitalizations are unvaccinated. But what this also means in this case is that 19% of those hospitalized have been vaccinated. And I'm surprised sometimes, because people say, they were vaccinated and they got the virus. Well, not only can people that are vaccinated get the virus, they can be hospitalized. Mm-hmm. And this is data that's been public for quite a while. So it's to me, it's not a surprise that there are people that are vaccinated. They get it, they can spread it, and they get hospitalized.
And they die.
Pardon me?
Some of them die.
And some of them die.
But that death rate is a lot lower
among
the vaccinated.
Right.
So what I've read is more similar to what you've read, is that those that are vaccinated have a lower rate of being hospitalized, milder symptoms, and less chance of dying. That they do get it, they do get hospitalized, and some can't die.
Another interesting, those people, you wonder, the 167, did they have comorbidities that even though they got the vaccination, were there other things that weakened their immune system or?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I know that they're tracking so much information, evidence with all these charts, mm-hmm. and sometimes, I've heard presentations from Children's Hospital, boy, there's a lot of information, and they might even know that now.
Yeah.
Health experts. So this looks at, this is again hospitalizations, but instead of looking, I think the other one was it? Was that the other one? Was it the hospital level? Yeah. This looks at the patient level and by age. And over here we have 0 to 9 and then 10 to 19. And sorry that.
So that, what, 3%?
Approximately 3%. Yeah. And there's a couple things here is that you can see, I'll show you what that looks like, that 3%. You can do it easily. That's under 20. Right there. So it's a small percent. But in this one, it was. Useful to see, I think, is, in the summer, this steep increase, this peak, I don't know exactly when that is, it's at least a couple weeks ago, and then this pretty precipitous drop-off in hospitalizations. And then this just highlights, you can see over here, and it's just the 10 to 19-year-olds, they're 1.98%. Of the hospitalized patients, and it shows up on the chart right there. Mm-hmm. Actually, both of these show up as that color. This looks at the epi curve, and it's done by region, and it's really showing whether cases are increasing or decreasing. And so on this chart, I just clicked right here where Elbert County is. We're part of the Northeast, which is blue, which is decline, sustained decline. So this region here has been in sustained decline since, and it doesn't really get precise on the date, at least as I did the screenshot. So this whole area of the state has been in sustained decline since this period here.
Looks like middle of September, mm-hmm. In the last 15 or so days.
Yeah, and I don't know whether this is a week.
Well, the middle one is September 16th, right?
Yeah, that's left. That is a 6th.
Right, where it goes from dark red to blue.
Yeah.
Right, and up here it talks a little bit more. The timing. Sorry that it's not bigger. I don't know. Because everything
just gets can't
distorted.
See.
Sorry, we can't see.
Doesn't matter what the size is sometimes.
Sorry.
Right. And so then this is incident trends. And these are two different scales and two different things. This is the number of incidents. And when it's increasing like this, you see. This line here is above zero, and it's red because it's increasing. But you can see the rate of increase from here to here is slowing. It's still increasing, but at a slower rate. To this point right here, September 13th or something like that, where the rate actually begins to drop. And so even though this curve is going up, this curve could go up like all the way over here, and it would still be a decreasing rate, just less. You can see the numbers over here. This one is that northeast zone that was on that from the previous map, that's basically us east and then north. It doesn't, it kind of goes on the outside of the metro area. And so there's the same trend there, where this was always increasing here from August 10th through September maybe 9th or 10th or something like that. And then it's been decreasing ever since. And it would have to get above this horizontal line here to be increasing again. So this is cases by age. And the box that surrounds the color is the percentage of the population that that age is. So you can see that there's a larger percentage in the state of 0 to 9-year-olds and a smaller percentage that have COVID. It's about equal percentages here, but you can see that the percentage of this age group 20 to 29, and this particular, I don't have it highlighted, but if you were to highlight it, it would tell you what percentage of the population the 20 to 29-year-olds make up, and then the percentage that have COVID. And again, you can see the numbers beginning to drop off here as of on this one. This is cases from before we were looking at hospitalizations sometime at the end of August.
Yeah, now that the purple is kind of equally dropping off, you know, at the end, the purple is, that's a little
this,
narrower.
You're saying that this, the percentage there seems to be staying static, whereas all of these others are shrinking. That one's going down, that one's getting smaller. Yeah. And if you go into this and you click right here, it'll highlight the percentage of that particular age group, and you can go to here the peak and you can see how much it's decreased. So this one, I believe, is deaths among cases by age, and it's a little bit different than the last one, because that was just cases. And here you can see the percentage of 80 plus year olds in the state is relatively small, but the percentage of deaths is very high. And the reverse is true here with the younger ages, where they make up a reasonable percentage of the state, but the percentage of deaths is very small. That make sense?
Yeah, it basically the same thing that they've said all along, over 70, 60, over 60.
Right, these over 70, even a little bit late 60s, have a much greater chance of dying from COVID. Whereas, I don't know, even under 49, much, much smaller. Relative to kind of how they're represented, so it's not as dangerous for say under 50-year-olds, and it's significantly more dangerous for over. This just highlights this group here, that 0.21% of all deaths are 10 to 19-year-olds, and the percentage of the population is 13%. That's this larger square, right? Is the 13%. And then that little tiny line that you can barely read is the 0.21%. And these two groups are actually highlighted right now on this timeline, and they're just barely visible.
Yeah.
Okay. This is, again, also deaths among COVID cases by the date of the death. This was a peak, a recent peak, was on the 5th of September, and there were 18. And if we go here, it's highlighting right there on September 23rd, too. So the recent high was 18 for that week, and then the recent high is 2. This is deaths among cases per 100,000. You can see the lighter the color on the map, the fewer. So Albert is 72.2 deaths per 100,000. Again, starting, this starts this chart at the bottom, whereas before I started at the top, and you can see Albert has one of the lowest in the state deaths per 100,000 at 71.2. Back to the beginning. So, you know, I can't explain these numbers, like why does Elbert County have a relatively low death rate relative to other counties? You know, you can see Elbert is here. Look at me, it's kind of rad. Sorry. you know, you have Elbert, and then you have Boulder, and you have Douglas, all right here in the same range. You know, what's the difference between us and Boulder, and then Jefferson County, Denver, Arapahoe, Adams, and El Paso? I mean, they're suburban, they're, you know, and we're rural, but what about some of these other rural communities? I don't have the answers.
And we're,
to those.
You know, the bedroom community, right? So a lot of the people that live here work in Denver, and
they're,
you know,
traveling
Douglas
to
County
all of
and,
these.
Yeah.
And when we saw those case rates and that they were higher.
Yeah.
So.
Huh.
And I think that when you look at the three categories of things, deaths, hospitalizations, and cases, hospitalizations and deaths are, those numbers have got to be like either precise or very accurate, right? Because you have a coroner who declares a death, there's a reason for it. You have hospital admissions. Whereas cases, you could say, depend on how many people are getting tested and where they live. Mm-hmm. So they might work here, but they don't live here. And so that number is probably a little bit less reliable. But when you see a pattern among all three, say fewer cases, fewer hospitalizations, and fewer deaths, it's not an inconsistent number,
right?
Especially where these ones would have greater reliability, comparability. So.
Thank you for pulling that for us. I looked at the website, I don't know, a couple of weeks ago, and I just kind of crossed my eyes and went on to another website.
I want to see the influenza overlay
on top
of this and see how it compares.
Yeah. So, we continue to have students come into our schools and some staff with the virus. I think we're probably fewer that come in knowingly than when we started the school year, where people thought it was just a cold, and then they got their kids sent home, where they came in sometimes well and then developed a fever and we sent them home. So I think many parents have gotten the message,
keep them home.
But it's not perfect. We still have students coming in where there's somebody in the household who has all the symptoms or has had a positive test, and they have various reasons. They think because they're vaccinated, because they had it before, they can come in. So we've seen spread in a couple of cases within our schools. And we're tracking the positive cases very closely. We're not tracking all of the exposed individuals closely, except if they become positive. And so what we want to know, is there any school-based connection between any of the positive cases? So, for example, over the last probably 3 weeks, maybe a little bit longer, we've had a number of cases at the high school in the 9th grade and the 10th grade. And the, you know, I'll just pick a number. Let's just say there's 10 or 12 in the 9th grade or the 10th grade. That number alone doesn't tell us a lot about what's happening in the school, other than people are coming in with the virus. Except that we haven't been able to identify classrooms where other students got it, and we don't believe they got it outside of school because they are not friends outside of school, and they were in multiple classrooms together, classes, and they were close. And that's the pattern that we've seen in 2 or 3 cases. There's another pattern that we've seen, is if there's 2 students who come into a classroom with the virus, and they're in close proximity to other students for an extended amount of time, 3 or 4 hours, there's a much higher chance that those students will get the virus. But 1 student in a classroom that's closed for an hour and a half, we haven't seen that happening. Right? So what our principals have done is really looking at how they can reduce the amount of extended close proximity the students have. But the problem, especially at the high school, is it can be very disruptive to set a protocol to say, you know, don't sit next to your friends all day long. You know, and then what about seating charts? And what about the teachers being able to manage where kids are sitting? And we have had at least one of the cases where 2 students were in the same class. We believe they got it over the weekend because they developed symptoms on Monday. And they both developed symptoms around the same time, and they were friends. But they were around a few other students in 2 or 3 classes that day, and then one of those students got it a couple days later, and then another one a day later, and so we've been able to say there's a high likelihood that they got it in school. But we're also comparing that to all the other students who've come in with the virus, and nobody gets it. And right. That's been by far the largest percentage of students. I don't know the number, but 75% or more of the students that come in with the virus, there is no spread. It might 90%. I haven't done that math. It's only to say that we are seeing a little bit more spread within the school than we did last year, where we only saw 2 cases.
Right.
And we believe that that has to do with a couple of things. One is last year we had masks, and this year we don't. And second, that the Delta variant is approximately twice as infectious. And so we think that those 2 things are probably contributing to a little bit more spread than we had. I mean, we had so little last year, anything is more. But it doesn't seem to be spreading if you're just with somebody for 5 or 10 or 15 minutes. I mean, last year the protocol was 6 feet or less for more than 15 minutes. Well, we're seeing 6 feet or less for more than 5 times that amount, an hour and a half. And there hasn't been spread, or in the elementaries even more. It really takes this more extended close proximity and 2 students versus 1. And we're working on how to reduce that risk of 2 students and the extended proximity. So all the things that you know, but especially getting outside more, the high school has been excellent about getting the kids outside. They like it, and just more routinely. So if we have, like, for example, the 9th grade, had a number of cases, you know, get the 9th grade classes outside, looking at less group work, where students spend a long time really close and a lot of talking, making sure that there is appropriate distancing. We're not telling teachers at any level what they have to do with how they position the students, but just being aware that the more that they're in close proximity for a longer period of time, the greater chance. We, shifting gears a little bit still in COVID, we signed up for the Binax at-home rapid tests in early August when they first, around when they first announced the program. We didn't get our first test until...
About a couple weeks ago?
Which was close to when they said they would begin the program. We had about 100 left over from spring, and then we were able to get an emergency shipment of 300 from the state before this new program began. And we've been getting shipments about every other day, maybe.
Every day.
And we got one today. And just we've been distributing them to the schools. They're by the, either the front out, the front desk or the health office has been giving them out, often in collaboration with the district nurse. Will say, you know, we have tests, you know, if you want to go pick them up, here's how you can use them. And
just when there's symptoms, right? And are we...
Most of the time when there's symptoms. Yeah. But like if somebody at home has it, we've been giving them to them. Yeah. We would like to give more out, but because we're getting fewer than we expected, whatever it was now 3 weeks ago, to have 900, and instead we got 250. And those 250 were in two packs. So we actually had a pack, 125 packs.
Oh,
and we were thinking we were going to have 900. So we've had to be a little bit more restrictive than we'd like, rather than, here, take as many, you know, take one for your whole family, one for each member of your family. We have done that in some cases where, not, like, a lot of people in the household are sick. Great, take six or more, because we know it can be helpful to the family. In other cases, we've been a little bit, just take one or two, if you need more, come back. But the feedback we've gotten from parents and from staff is that they've been really helpful. So the program has been in very high demand, so the state is kind of cautioning people as they sign up to get them delivered directly to their homes to, like, be patient, because it could be a 7 to 14 day wait for that. We're fortunate that we don't have that wait right now, and so it's just really easy for parents to take the tests and to have the information about whether there's somebody in the household that's positive and then or not, and then plan accordingly. So the best use is when somebody is sick. That's when there's the highest reliability for those tests. So we'll keep distributing those as generously as possible. And that's a key, I think some people somehow discount that's a key part of our strategy. And it's been, you know, Michael Mina, guy from Harvard, that's been advocating for testing since the beginning. Free, rapid, kind of ubiquitous testing, and that gives people information. And so that's a, if we didn't have the ability to provide students and staff and family members these tests where they can find out quickly the answer, they don't have to wait 2 or 3 days, you know, go to someplace in Castle Rock or Parker, wait another couple of days for a test. It's disruptive to family life, disruptive to their job, disruptive to students and being in school, because you know, if they test negative and they don't have symptoms, then they can come back. So it's been a key part of our strategy, and it's luckily it's worked pretty well because we have that.
I'd love to figure out how to get them for our company, you know, just to get, you know, a bunch of them, because I, you know, I had a person that wasn't feeling well, so I said, go get tested, go home, go get tested, and it took 2 days, and they were negative. So if we would have been able to, you know, use the rapid test, she may not have even gone home. She wasn't feeling that bad.
Right.
But, you know.
And that's been the biggest struggle. People have seasonal, like, hay fever or allergies this time of year. Typically, you know, I'll get a sinus infection or they have colds. And so many kids are used to, not just the kids, but the parents, you know, are coming going to work, a little under the weather, for whatever reason, right? They don't want to let their colleagues down. It's more work to plan for a sub than it is to actually teach. They have childcare issues at home. A multitude of reasons that include habit. So we're really trying to break that just with each day and each situation and each communication. But I think that so many people have gotten the message, and a lot of people have picked up the test because they want to meet our expectations. They know that it's important. They don't want to be the ones to, you know, send their child in and they're positive and it creates an issue. So.
That's good.
Anyway. Do you have any questions? Do you have any?
That's good.
It's
a good hour, though.
It was a good hour. It was.
Excellent.
Yes.
Hopefully you all saw the message that was sent out by Jason last week.
Yes.
On the legislative visit.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That had a video, a four-minute video about that.
It was great.
That went really, really smoothly. And
I would have much rather been there. Now I know how to write code almost.
Lucky
it was
you.
Bad all day. Just, yeah, anyway.
So Kim was there. I don't know if you have any comments, Kim.
Oh, I thought it was great. I the kids that got up there and talked, I felt so bad for some of the kids. They were so scared. You could see the fear in their eyes of introducing who they were and what grade they were. And then and it's like you could, like you're sitting there, everyone, you could just see everybody leaning to try to hear them. And then the next child started talking because they were so quiet. And they were just nervous. So, but it was neat. It was neat to see it. I loved the interaction from the kids. The three high school seniors, I think there were three of them, boy, they really interacted well with the group when they asked questions like, so what's your plans for after when you graduate, or do you have this? I mean, boy, they just jumped in there, and they were great.
Nice.
It was a great presentation for the school. I was very impressed with it.
Good.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for being there.
Huh?
Thanks for being there.
Oh, yeah.
Some of them didn't even know, you know, 20 minutes before. So the idea was not to have a canned presentation,
right,
and to just get a number. I don't remember how many we had. 18 people, maybe? Presenting to them was just a little bit from each one. What matters to you? What do you like most about your school? And there was really a range of answers. There were probably some themes in terms of relationships with other students, relationships with colleagues, relationships between students and teachers primarily. People really seemed to value that a lot. But you could tell that for them, both teaching and learning wasn't just about academics.
Yeah.
You know, there was a lot that was really about the social dynamic.
And the community.
And the community. Mm-hmm. And, you know, whether the state legislators like it or not, the policymakers, that's the reality of schools.
Yes.
And that's why the pandemic, I think, has been so difficult, because it has disrupted the social life, the social aspect of schools so much. And you could just hear it. I mean, they didn't talk a lot about COVID. I mean, that wasn't really the focus. But you could see that the social dynamic was an important part of everybody's answer, almost everybody's.
That's great.
So. It was great. Like I said, the kids stayed fantastic.
That's good.
Yeah, they represented the school district well. That's good. And the teachers, too, of course, that talked.
And the board. You represent the board.
Yes,
you did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, Kim didn't speak. I spoke very little. Brett spoke very little. We focused on the kids and the teachers.
Good. That's great.
There was a counselor. And then Legacy, we included Legacy. We produced, we can give you one tonight, a handout that Jason put together just for the event and kind of summarize the district. And gave that, so that we weren't giving them information that they could get in writing.
Right.
And so it was nice that Legacy came over as well. We're part of the district.
Right.
Nice.
Okay.
Is that it? You done?
I'm done.
Okay. Thank you. That was a good presentation.
Yeah.
Moving on to the consent agenda. To the consent agenda. Can I get a motion to approve items 8.1 through 8.5?
So, second.
Roll call, please.
Director Pankendorf?
Yes.
Director Krumpfeller?
Yes.
Director Hines?
Aye.
Director Karcher?
Aye.
Moving on to action items, can I get a motion to approve item 9.1, first reading of revised policies, JEB, entrance age requirements?
So okay. Moved.
Thank you.
Second.
Discussion?
Thank you.
Roll call, please.
Director Pankendorf?
Yes.
Director Krumpfeller?
Yes.
Director Hines?
Aye.
Director Karcher?
Aye.
Moving on to 9.
Can I hear
you? You can.
So,
you may.
Just on the agenda, first reading of revised policies, I think that applies only to 9.1.
Correct.
Right.
And 9.2 isn't a first reading of a revised policy.
No, it's a resolution.
It's a separate, because it's a book.
Yeah. Just doing that clear for the record.
Just, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay. So can I get a motion to approve item 9.2, resolution addressing remote learning during the 2021-2022 school year? And this is just updating a resolution that was passed a year ago that addresses remote learning.
So moved.
Second.
In discussion?
Yes. Just to clarify that we last year offered 100% online learning.
Right.
This resolution, that remote learning is not that. We are not offering 100% online learning this year. So this is when a student is excluded for a health reason and is well enough to continue to learn at home.
Mm-hmm.
For whatever reason, the principals authorize that. So it's not, you know, oh, I'm gonna just learn from home for the next month. And when that happens, this policy addresses those cases. So the remote learning is temporary learning from home when they are well enough to continue to learn but can't be at school.
Okay.
And the primary case is when they've been exposed to the virus in the household. But that's not the only reason. They might have been exposed at school. A parent is concerned that, oh, okay, there was, you know, in their classroom, was it first grade at Singing Hills?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That class went remote for a week.
Okay.
That's what this resolution addresses.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you for the clarification. Any more discussion? Roll call, please.
Director Pankendorf?
Yes.
Director Krumpfeller?
Yes.
Director Hines?
Aye.
Director Karcher?
Aye.
There are no discussions. Items on the BOE planning, our next meeting, special board meeting is October 4th. And we do have a number of eligible candidates to interview that night. So I just wanted to put a couple things forth and let you guys think about it, or we can talk about it tonight. Keeping the interviews about 15 minutes each if we can,
yep.
Somewhere around there. We need to discuss order of interviews. Maybe the order that the applications were received would be the order.
Yeah.
I don't know what you guys think, or alphabetically.
That makes sense to me. The order that they were received makes sense.
I like it.
And we need to do it in the most non-biased way that we can.
Which I think that's very,
okay.
Very fair.
Okay. And asking the candidates to voluntarily wait in the waiting room so that nobody has the advantage of sitting there listening. Obviously, the first person, everybody would hear their questions and answers
right.
On down the road, so
right.
That would be
right.
Giving somebody an advantage. So asking them to voluntarily wait in the waiting room. Just, that's all I have. Do you guys have anything else you want to discuss?
No, I think it's very clear.
The meeting's at 6 o'clock.
And the meeting starts at 6 o'clock.
Okay.
Yeah.
A couple... questions. One is, do you want it live streamed? And you don't have to answer that now, but
we would have to make that decision. Right, and that would keep, that way people don't feel like they have to bring their whole family with them, possibly, and have a crowded boardroom. So it's not a bad idea. What do you guys think?
To have it live streamed, is that what you're asking?
I just worry about it being a mechanism for somebody to listen to the questions that are being asked.
Right. That's a good point, yeah.
Well, if they're all sitting out there together.
Yeah, but all it takes is a little earbud.
That's true.
Right.
And on the phone with their
significant other.
Yeah.
Be prepared, here's the question.
Right. I don't...
I hope nobody would do that.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't think for an interview process that it should be live streamed.
Okay. I agree. Yeah.
Okay.
Agree.
Okay.
So the room could be quite filled, and you're okay with that?
Yeah.
Open windows and get your air purifiers over here.
And then the other questioner
It was pretty filled that night when we had the presentations of everybody. I wouldn't think it'd be more filled than that.
I think that night we had 25 people in the room.
Yeah, we had quite a few.
So we could probably set it up so it's a little bit different than this, so that it has more. This is more for a large number of people, so it could be set up so that it would accommodate more in the audience.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
The meeting on the 11th is where you would be voting to make the appointment. At that time, what you would do is make a motion to appoint someone, get a second, there would be discussion, and vote on it, and in the motion to say that the person would be appointed, or would your appointment would become official after they've been sworn in, and they need to be sworn in within 10 days of the decision, and that swearing in doesn't have to be in a public meeting. The board president can do it,
and so can Shelley, right?
Yeah, I think with a notary public or board president. And so that just has to happen within 10 days of your vote, and then effective when they're sworn in, they would be a board member, and then they would be in the next board meeting. So they wouldn't actually be a board member in the meeting that you're voting. It would be the next board meeting, and then technically once they're sworn in.
All.
I was trying to think if there were other questions that had come up about the process, because it's so infrequent that
board. It is very
so infrequent. you're going to update everything on the system so we can pull them up. So okay.
Do I have anything else?
No.
Okay. So then after that, our next regular board meeting is October 11th, and we need everybody there.
Okay.
Do I have anything else?
So many logistical things.
There are. I've been, I think I told you today, I've been on CASB's website more in the last month than I have in the last 8 years, so but it's really helpful. Actually, when you get in there, they have a lot of good, helpful information on this board candidate thing. That's where I've been trying to get a lot of my information. Okay, so we don't have an executive session, so I will adjourn this meeting at 7:14 p.m.